Now here's A Terrible Beauty, a two-part series which explores women's lives in 1916. Part two of series two today, entitled Fallen, presented by Debbie Hutchinson, joined by Leah Mills and women from reading groups in Dublin and Belfast.
I think there's a few different questions that I wanted to address. I think that choosing her, the main character, as a history student with a history degree, and then her research into monuments. Monuments are statues, they're not living. And she becomes, she gets to know the story behind the statues. But I think one of the strongest passages in the book is about the ghosts of 1914 and the soldiers. And I think they're becoming ghosts at that particular point, as soon as the 1916 rising happens, because that is living history. She's a history student. She's looking at things that have gone past. But what's really effective in the novel is that she's moving all the time throughout that the Easter Monday and the Tuesday and the Wednesday, and she's moving through a city, and that's what history is. It's happening as we don't know it's happening, but it's happening. So it's a very, it's an organic thing. It's not something that you can, you know, we do read about and we can commemorate and everything, but when it's happening, it happens on a personal level, but it's also happening to a city, you know. And I think that when the city goes up in flames, that's really the beginning of the end for the collective, for the memory of the veterans.
Yeah,
they're going up in smoke. And I thought that was a really strong passage when she sees them, when she describes them in the buildings and screaming and their limbs, because they're being killed again, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, they've already gone through the actual physical death, but now they're going to be erased from a nation's memory.
The flames made a weird kind of light, bright and dark at once. A horde of fiery ghosts, thousands of slaughtered soldiers from the front, come home to vent their fury. They thrash their limbs about, struggled with the window frames, strained to break free, fell back and shoved fiery fists across the streets to rattle the roofs with flaming fingers, their breath black with rage. The river was oily and orange, its surface a canvas of wavering, hot colours. My throat burned. My skin and eyes were dry, inflammable as paper.
Did you do any kind of research into diaries or kind of memoirs of women around that time, or where did you get that?
A book that influenced me a great deal was Vera Brittain.
Testament of Youth.
Exactly, Testament of Youth. But actually, even more than that, there were letters from a lost generation.
Yes.
Where Vera Brittain exchanged letters with four different men during the war. One was her fiancé, Roland Layton, who was killed. Another was her brother, Edward, who was also killed. And then two of Roland and Edward's friends, who were also killed. So none of those young men survived the war.
Right.
And her account in that, and in her memoir of what it was like to be a young woman with the men she cared about in the war, and going to visit Roland Layton's mother, and she was there when his effects came home. And in fact, and I say this in the author's note, that that scene in Vera Brittain's book, I had to put it down and go away from it for a few days while I digested that. It was so powerful, that sense of it, and that's why I had to have a scene like it in the novel.
The trunk's latch clicked open. Dad lifted the lid. Liam's tunic rose as though it breathed. A mucky, sickening stench seeped through the room. It coated my tongue, stung in my throat. Mother pressed a handkerchief to her face. God help us, what is that smell? Dad lifted a corner of the tunic to look beneath it. Let's see, what does he have here? Oh no, look, Mildred, the watch is broken. I looked over his shoulder. The open face of the pocket watch Dad gave Liam when he went to work for the firm, his own father's gift to him, was smashed, the hands long gone. He groped for it, like a blind man. I knelt beside him to his hand, closed his fingers over its face. Then I lifted the khaki tunic and hugged it. Never mind the stink. The arms unfolded and hung at an angle, stiff and empty. I let go and the khaki slid to my lap. I pushed it to the floor, rubbed my palms on the rug to get rid of its greasy residue.
Could I ask Leah a question about Katie's mother?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why was she so horrible?
I don't know. I think because when I was thinking about young middle-class women at the time mm-hmm. and how constrained we had always imagined them to mm-hmm. be, and how at this time everything was kind of breaking down and women were going out and doing their own thing and they were walking around town on their own and they were going where they wanted to go, I had to give Katie something to push against.
Yeah.
And her mother was just always that thing for me. And I know somebody asked me very in an early interview, was that my experience with my mother, that she would have been trying? My mother was the opposite, because there were six of us and she was widowed early and she had to work to support all of us. And she always said, never rely on a man to support
you. Yeah.
So she was the opposite.
Yeah.
The door to the professor's office was open when I arrived. She was reading at her desk, but she put the book aside and seemed glad to see me, till I told her why I'd come. She took a stub of yellow pencil out from behind her ear and rolled it over and back between her fingers. I don't understand, Miss Crilly. Do you not want the opportunity? Of course I do, I fidgeted like a schoolgirl in my seat. It's my parents. They won't allow it. I thought I could persuade them, but... How old are you? Her tone drew blood to my face. 22. She stabbed a series of holes in her blotter with the pencil. Can you not reason with them? Are they not proud of you? I'd come third in my year and won a medal for an essay on Wolfe Tone, but this was the absolute last thing likely to make my mother proud. She was as staunch a unionist as you could hope to find. My mother says one degree is bad enough. It's an utter waste of money. Then why did they send you here at all? I looked at her cropped hair and plain clothes. My twin brother wouldn't come unless they let me come too. In fact, she and Liam had won me the right to study here between them. As recently as 7 years earlier, being a woman, I wouldn't have been admitted to college in the first place. Professor Hayden and her clever friends had fought the larger battles that changed all that. You have a brother. She looked out the window at the unnaturally blue sky, not a cloud in sight. Let's hope the war ends soon. In fact, I had two brothers, best not to mention Matt, the youngest, the baby of the house, who was about to sit for repeats of the first year exams he had spectacularly failed. She dropped her pencil. It rolled off the blotter and across the desk, picking up speed. We both watched its progress. She waited, caught it as it fell off the edge. I suppose your mother thinks we've ruined you. I tried to smile. Something like that. Would it help if I spoke to her? No. My conviction seemed to startle her. I can be diplomatic. I shook my head. It wouldn't help. A thing you want is worth fighting for. There was nothing I wanted more, but it wasn't that simple, as she must have known. She and my mother were of an age, but they might as well have lived in different centuries on different continents. I could hardly tell the professor that my mother despised women like her who campaigned for the franchise. She dropped the pencil into a chipped cup that held several others and got to her feet. Well, it's a shame. Come and see me if the situation changes. She walked me to the door, shook my hand, and turned back to her desk with what looked like relief.
I could understand wanting, when you're in grief, you get quite jealous and possessive about things that have been mm-hmm. left. And then you'd kind of focus in. A lot of people, that happens in families. Mm-hmm. You get obsessed about a possession, mm-hmm. like a ring. That's mm-hmm. not her ring. Mm-hmm. I could really understand the it's just grief. It's mm-hmm. just hurt. It's not about the ring. But it's just about... getting some, just diverting your grief to
There was an allusion, I think, from Lockie, or at least Katie picked that up from Lockie, that clearly her mother didn't know she was going to have twins, and that there was some sort of disappointment when the second child emerged mm-hmm. as a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you meant that or if that was just...
I meant for Katie to have that sense, but again, I think it's part of the grief that she feels as well. It's that mm-hmm. kind of survivor guilt mm-hmm. that she has, that the wrong twin
But she and her brother seem to be, you know, you hear about twins who are completely intertwined with each other and others who are quite different from each other. She and her brother, I could understand the depth of her grief because they were allies in everything.
June 1915. 2 months later, on the day that should have been our birthday, the longest day of the year, I spread Liam's letters out on the bed and reread them in the order they had been written. I knew them off by heart. In January, not long after he went to the front, he'd sent a letter to Mother, full of certainty that he would come through the war unscathed. Half an hour ago, Jerry sent a storm of shells over. I thought I was a goner. I heard a rumbling Mary come my way. That's a 17-inch, in case you don't know. But could I run or throw myself clear? No, I couldn't budge. You'll think I was afraid, but no. I was up to my knees in mud, gripped as tight as though someone poured a ton of cement on me. I stood there, braced for the worst, and the sound roared right on by. After all that, it was only a field ambulance I heard, straining along the track in high gear. The whole thing was over in a flash, longer in the telling than in the happening. So, you see, my life is charmed. There's no call to worry about me. Our last billet was blown to smithereens not long after we'd left it. That building was 100 years old anyway. It's nothing but a mess of old rubble now, you know, and here I am still in one ugly piece. I should have known better than to believe him. He was cheerful for my parents' benefit, knowing his letters to them would be read out loud as soon as they arrived, and many times over. They were passed around Mother's sewing circles until the paper wore thin and the ink on the edge of the pages got smudged from too much handling. The letters he wrote to me were darker, meant for my eyes only. A shadow fell on them and deepened as the wet, bitter winter dragged on.
As part of my research for the novel, I read an awful lot of letters that soldiers had written home. I went to the Imperial War Museum and read some real letters there. And also there's a really good website, firstworldwar.com, where they have a lot of letters up. But since the book came out, the National Archive in the UK have published all of the letters. I think there are millions of letters that are online. And I'm really glad they hadn't done that, actually, because I might still be reading the letters and I wouldn't have got the novel written. But yes, some of those letters were very frank and very forthright. And Vera Brittain says at one stage in one of her books, I can't remember which one, but she says that it was as if men and women had to learn to talk to each other differently if they were going to have any real conversation. And I thought that was interesting as well. You know, we think about women's lives changing because they were able to go out and do these things they'd never done before, like drive ambulances, or for middle class women to go and work in factories at a rate that they never had before. Although working class women have always had to go out and work.
So,
yes, but the idea that the communication between the sexes became more equal as well is something that interested me. Another thing that made me angry when I came to realise was the extent to which ordinary people in Dublin risked their own lives to go out and help people who'd been hurt. And we never heard a word about that.
I did find that was a really interesting part of the novel. I remember in school, 1916, from what I remember, it was very dramatic. And I think the reason why it was dramatic was because it was, on a smaller scale, people were killed, like the martyrs, the revolutionaries, the rebels that were murdered, you know, executed. And I just found that very, very stark.
That's what the focus
and dramatic
was, yeah.
Because it was, you know, that changed everything. But I didn't really think about the people in Dublin being killed. I actually, that was like a separate part of it.
That's
completely.
What I mean. It was two separate parts, wasn't it? It was like the martyrdom was that's what you spent most time in
but
school
that comes
on.
With every war, it's always the civilians who are the big. I mean, you only have to look at what's happening now in Syria.
Exactly.
How could, what is it, something like 2 million people have been displaced internally in a country, and a leader thinks nothing of, you know, bombing and killing and all of that. So it's always the ordinary people who come off the worst and who have to live with the consequences.
And that was another thing that really shocked me, because it wasn't hard to find the statistics. And people had always spoken about the 16 men who were executed as if those were the only lives that were lost in the rising, whereas in fact 485 people died in the space of a week in a small area, and 100,000 people had to go on relief afterwards because they had lost everything in
their
fires. And that was a third of the population of the city at the time.
Yeah.
But we never heard that.
It's funny that they I mean, is that I think that successive governments have taken the rising and they've kind of manufactured it into what they want us to believe, I think.
Yeah, I think, but it's further complicated, I think, because the Civil War so happened so quickly
afterwards.
Yeah. And then we're all aware of the casualties. And I think, you know, at that of that time and the civilian casualties and the brother versus brother and all of that. And I think that that more or less eclipsed the story of the casualties in Dublin.
Yes.
They were just two contrasting stories, you know. It was, I don't think they wanted to really put them in together.
But in reference to what you said, Debbie, you could perhaps use the feminist point that history is his story. It's not our story or her story. It's his story. And it's the same, I mean, it's going on all over the world again. Male politicians, generally speaking, not manufacture, but kind of fashion the story into what suits their agenda.
Yeah, and I think that's what really interested me when I read the book was her kind of preoccupations as a young woman as well. I think women in war and women in situations of conflict have different preoccupations and maybe they're not drawn into, I don't know, people can disagree or disagree, maybe they're not drawn into conflict. Is it because of their temperament or is it because they've too many responsibilities and they've other stuff to do in society? So for instance, Katie, she's still running around trying to look after her family. You know, she's risking her life running across the city to visit her sister, whereas the men are pretty much focused on the battle. I don't know if other people got that from the book. Or
I would agree with you, Debbie, on that. I think if we look back through history, there have been a very small number of women, right, through history that we know of, who have been able to rise to the top during war and conflict and to take that risk to rise their head above the parapet. But in general, I think, yeah, women do are actually have enforcements placed upon them by their family and by culture to actually be overly feminine, to focus only on the feminine aspect and less so on the masculine aspect. Male and female, you know, both genders have the equal essence of male and female, but it's, we're cultured into it. We're socialised into it.
Pearl, you were going to say something.
Could it be that the men were trying to protect the female?
Yes.
And look after them in that sense. They were taking the burden and saying, you stay home, we'll do it.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
Could be, But when she goes out, she I think you kind of touch on it, but when she goes out, she gets this sense that there's something bigger she should be involved in. That's what when she goes to the hospital, she kind of thinks, oh God, you know, why can't I get involved here? And she keeps getting controlled by other people
I think that is, you know, the risk of getting into major trouble with the gender people. I think that is the innate response of the female.
Okay, yeah.
To help.
To nurture, to care, to help, to
pick up the pieces.
You know, see, just to be doing something and to be, you know, not shouldering a gun. A few of them did, of course. But, I mean, the woman who was driving around picking up casualties, the women who were working as volunteers in the hospital. That's what women do, and women have always done that during war. Do you look at any political party today in any part of the United Kingdom or Ireland? Is the women who are behind the scenes raising the funds, delivering the leaflets, addressing the envelopes? I have to say I'm guilty of all those things. But, you know, they're the people who sort of keep the engine running. And it's the men who are out front making statements. But, you know, if you took away all that female support in any organisation, never mind a political organisation, the whole thing would collapse.
So, Hubie, what did we think of him?
I think Hubie clearly was damaged. As were so many men. And I mean, I was interested that you'd heard stories about your grandfather.
My maternal.
Because most men came back from the First World War, couldn't talk about it.
That's
was so awful.
That's right.
But he, of course, He was angry, he was resentful. And I wonder, did she escape into that sexual relationship with him as an escape from grief?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the language you use to describe the encounters is so passionate. And, you know, her skin burning. And then there was a bit I read earlier on in the train about his eyes and his amazing eyes with all the shades of green stuff.
Yeah. I've never met anybody like him.
But,
she could lose himself in the pool.
I normally find love scenes quite cringy, but that's fantastically written.
Well, I have to say to you, you'll definitely, you know, there's a good sex award, I think.
It's actually a bad sex award. And in fact, there is a reviewer who will remain nameless who really disagrees with you all.
Really?
Who, in an otherwise very positive review of the novel, said, but we won't talk about the cringe-inducing sex scenes. And I thought,
I disagree totally.
No, I disagree absolutely. And what I liked about it was...
It was very discreet. That
it was, you know, less is more. We weren't getting all the sort of the detail, the physical, practical detail. It was just the whole emotional thing. Yeah. I thought that was so beautifully written. And you could just... You could feel how she was feeling. And, it was...
For me, what that relationship was about, it wasn't just a sexual thing. It's... Katie is damaged too, and she's been damaged by grief, and she's in a kind of stupor, you know, the kind of shock that you feel when you lose somebody really close to you. And so she's moving towards a point where she has to choose whether to move forward in her life, whether to choose life or to stay stuck in that backward looking grief. And so for me, I think in writing the novel, that's what the sex is about. It's about looking for a connection with somebody and moving on.
Hubie started out as just almost as a messenger from Liam, I suppose, and as somebody who would... Liam left the novel to go to the front, and Hubie leaves the front to come into the novel. So there was that kind of parallel thing going on, I think, in my head. And it's easy to look back and impose reasons on it when that isn't necessarily how it happened. But he is a very difficult character in some ways, but he's very forthright. And Katie responds to that because she's a person who cares about the truth. Mm. And she feels that Hubie will tell her the truth and he will take her seriously. And if he asks her something, he wants to know the answer. He's not dismissing her just because she's a young woman who doesn't know what he's talking about.
Part where he says, "You're not at all like Liam." What did you mean by that part?
I think because that was a point for me where Katie stepped away from, you know, we were talking inside about how she has to choose ultimately, does she want to live or die? Does she want to move on with her life or does she want to stay looking back and stay in her grief the way that some people do choose to do that, that they would rather stay cocooned in grief rather than move on into life. And so that's the choice that she has to make. And in a way, she is kind of imagining that Hubie is a connection with Liam. And for her, that means that there are things that she will never have to explain to him because he knew Liam. But he's saying that was a different thing. Mm. You're your own person.
I want to say this, if I say nothing else, the idea of Two Cities, One Book and this particular book, I just thought was wonderful.
Yeah.
And to be here and have an opportunity to share this with my sisters is wonderful.
Thank you.
I have to say that was absolutely my favourite thing about the Two Cities, One Book experience as well. You know, there were so many incredible things that happened, but for me that was the thing that meant the most, is the whole exchange between readers in Dublin and Belfast and the opportunity to go to libraries in the north and to talk to audiences there, readers there, and I don't know, just to advance our understanding of each other a little bit. And I think post-Brexit as well, I think all of this becomes so much more important.
Mm-hmm.
No, really, really important and urgent that we keep those connections going.
There's more that unites us than divides us.
Well, I've always said that, and I've always said to contemporaries, because obviously I was a wife and a mother during the height of the Troubles. And I always said that the Irish North and South have more in common with each other than either of us have with the English. Mm-hmm. And yet, so many people in Northern Ireland identify with what they say British.
They don't really mean English.
They don't really mean English.
They mean this mythical British.
That was A Terrible Beauty, part 2 of series 2 today, entitled Fallen, written by Leah Mills, presented by Debbie Hutchinson, and joined also by women from reading groups in Dublin and Belfast.